Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Aaron Richards is education reporter and editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's written a very lengthy and important article that appears in the winter issue 2017 of the American Prospect. It's titled Milwaukee's Voucher Verdict. What, 26 years? It's hard to believe it's been going on for 26 years, but we started all of this. What 26 years of vouchers can teach the private school choice movement if only it would listen. She wrote this in conjunction with a Spencer Fellowship. It's a year-long fellowship for education reporters that pays them a stipend to be able to leave the newsroom and to go to New York City for a year to immerse themselves at Columbia University's Journalism School and Education School and to then work on a project that they choose. And she chose voucher schools because she wanted to learn about the history here in Milwaukee. And she also had a chance to hear from the people who are going to be at the forefront of education in this country, at least nationally, with Betsy DeVos being a somewhat controversial nomination to be Secretary of Education. She has a deep interest in the school choice movement, and we'll talk more with Aaron about what that is. But it's a really interesting look, because sometimes people just throw out these words and you don't know the history, so why not study what's happened here in the city of Milwaukee, which is exactly what she did. And many of you listening are familiar with our setup here and have a lot of thoughts about expansion of voucher schools, of what's going to happen with public education, what the future is, and really, ultimately, what is the best way to educate children. And we thank you very much, Aaron, for being with us. I'm so glad you had time to take this on, because sometimes you have to do you're under deadline, you have to do a story, but here you had time to really look at a very important issue, because the face of education is changing in this country.
You know, it really is. And I think that in the daily news world, we sometimes don't put a premium on the value of examining history. And how did we get to where we are now? How did policies change over time? How did the energy behind movements change over time? And especially when it comes to education and private school choice, Milwaukee is, you know, sort of the place where a robust urban voucher school program started. And there wasn't a lot that I could find at the time that I was thinking about doing this fellowship. There wasn't a lot that had been written about where the movement had been and where it was going. And for my own edification, I'm not from Milwaukee. I wasn't here when this program was passed. And so it was really a chance for me to revisit a lot of the history in Milwaukee's sort of school choice scene and to kind of understand how we've gotten to where we are now, where we have a pretty divided education community here between, people that advocate for private schools that get public dollars to educate children. You have a public school system in the city. And then you also have a sector of charter schools, which are public, but sort of separate. Many of them operate separate from the district. And so to understand how, the interplay between all of those was, I think, a valuable experience.
You start the article, and I'm wondering how many situations are like this and how these schools could have been around for 20 years in some instances, and nobody looked at them and said, ooh, there's something really wrong here. Maybe this school shouldn't be in existence. You start with a young man, Tremaine Collier, who was looking for work last year. You write he heard about an opening at Syria, is that how you pronounce it?
Syria
Travis Academy, a private K-12 school. He has an online degree in business. He goes into the school. There are very few books, about 5 books in the library. He has no idea what's been taught before because there are no records. And then it turns out that the people running the school are quite unethical and have pocketed some money, and the school winds up closing. And yet it's been around for years and years, and there are other examples like this. It would appear to me that there's been a real problem with oversight of some of these schools. Private charter school or private choice schools might be just fine. The idea might be fine, but people need to know what's happening inside these schools.
Right. And to be clear, I think that the number of private schools that receive money in the form of vouchers in Milwaukee that are operating at this level is, I think there's a small segment of them. And if you ask around the community, from left to right, most people know which schools these are. The problem is, in many cases, they're not doing anything wrong by the letter of the law. It's not usually lack of resources or lack of teacher training that's the problem here, because according to state law, that's fine. They're private schools. usually these schools get shut down because they filed their financial paperwork wrong, or there's some other, in the event of gross negligence, the state can step in. But we don't have any mechanism after 26 years here to even have, any kind of oversight on these schools that even requires them to publish their graduation rates at the high school level. That's a pretty basic outcome measure. That I think most people would be interested in knowing for these private schools, and we just don't have that yet. And, Syria Travis Academy is a school that's struggled for a while. It is officially not operating this year. I've been to this school before. I've been inside. There are not very many resources for kids. Kids aren't really getting what appears to be a robust education during the day. But we don't have, you can't visit every single one of these schools and make sort of an arbitrary decision on what they're doing. I think where other states have been more successful, even places like Indiana that have passed private school choice programs in recent years, they do have an overarching requirement that all schools publish their graduation rates if you're getting public dollars. Actually, I think their private schools that don't get public money, I think, also have to publish their graduation rates. So there's a variety of other ways that oversight can work. And there just hasn't been a lot of discussion about that in Milwaukee and Wisconsin yet.
Well, and the idea of the whole program when it was started in 1990 was to give low-income, and it's predominantly African-American students in the Milwaukee area, a chance to go to top-notch private schools that a lot of people who have a lot more money send their children to, even though they're public schools because of their tax base are in many cases pretty darn good. But that I'm wondering if that happened. What happened to those private top-notch schools? How could you have, that was the mission of the program and the hope for the program, how could you have anything that didn't meet that? How can you allow a school like what you just outlined? That's not a private top-notch school. It wasn't the plan.
No, and I think that when you explain in theory how a voucher system could work, the idea that children in impoverished communities that don't have an option of a high-quality school in their neighborhood, a high-quality public school to go to deny those children the opportunity to go to a higher-performing school that, say, middle-class or upper-class kids would be able to go to. And when you say, well, those kids should get public money to go to an elite private school just like their upper-income peers. And I think that really makes sense to a lot of people. But in reality, I mean, some of our top-notch schools in the city, Marquette University High School, Divine Savior, Holy Angel, those are indeed voucher schools. Technically, they meet the letter of that definition because they have some kids in their school, a small number of them, that receive taxpayer-funded tuition vouchers to attend. And I think, when you look at the outcomes at those schools, I think the kids that are on vouchers in those schools are getting a really top-notch education. But that isn't what happened with the program. We opened the door for a lot of, in some cases, well-meaning but not terribly well-educated or well-versed in education individuals to open schools with very little oversight. And especially in the early years of the voucher program, there were a lot of abuses, a lot of reports of kids leaders spending their public dollars on,
cars.
Fancy cars,
right.
And, bloated salaries for them and their family members. And the people that were being the most shortchanged were kids who don't, have an opportunity to voice the fact that they might be getting a really unjust educational opportunity. So again, the question goes back to how do you ensure if we're going to have choice and allow people to take public dollars to other school options besides public schools, how do we ensure that those are high quality options? And by the same token, I do think the choice advocates have a point that there are a number of very low performing public schools.
Absolutely.
As well. And there isn't a lot that's being done at the moment to try to put in place policies or interventions that would have a significant impact on lifting the achievement at some of those really low performing and long time low performing public buildings.
You highlighted a religious school that's in the central part of Milwaukee, and I want you to talk about that. It seems to be a model, and you put the percentages of, in some of, most of these schools the proficiency in math and in reading is abysmally low. In this particular school, it's quite a bit higher, although it's not as high as you would like for it to be. I can't remember the name of the school, but it's close to here. And I'm wondering, the principal, who's an expat, I think, really has things under control. Kids are wearing uniforms. They've got art. They've got all kinds of things going on in the school. And it shows in terms of how well they're doing.
If you follow education issues in the city, you'll hear the name St. Marcus Lutheran School talked about quite a bit. It's run by a man named Henry Tyson, who is an advocate for children and an advocate for quality education. Came to this city, opened up a private school, is very focused on faith and community and trying to get kids who come from tough backgrounds a really high quality education. And he'll tell you that it was a struggle in the beginning. I mean, it's not the voucher, the cost of the voucher, which, you know, in recent years has fluctuated, you know, it's gone up now to around, you know, $7,500 or so per kid. That's not a lot of money per year to give a child of lesser means a robust educational experience. St. Marcus has done a really good job of marshaling resources from the community, getting donations, making sure that there is a robust staff of special education teachers to help kids with special needs and diverse learning needs. And, you know, you see that even Henry will say that, you know, he believes that quality should be the driver here, and that, for example, any school in the city that's scoring, you know, where 95% of kids are failing or more, you know, that they just can't get out of that cycle of low achievement, that any of those schools should be closed. And so he's really been a leader in pushing quality. The school is very popular. It's been expanding. It's on the north side of Milwaukee, close to sort of like First Street and Palmer. The campus is beautiful. It's been supported by donors who believe in the mission and believe in giving kids those opportunities. You know, and I think the question is also, is every parent able to get into that school? You know, it's sure become really popular, so, you know, it's tough to get in. You have to get in at the lower grade levels. People tend to stick around through the upper grade levels. Like a lot of voucher schools, it can't afford busing, so you're getting parents who are really devoted to getting their child to that school. And as a result of that, the school, I think, also has a better way of connecting with parents, because you see these parents when they drop their child off
They're
at school
involved.
Every day.
Yeah,
it's much different than sending your child across town on a city bus where you never have to interact with the school staff, and the school staff never gets a chance to interact with you.
Well, you're asking a lot then. You're asking a lot from the community and from donors. You shouldn't have to be, I don't think, in the business, if you're running a school, to have to go out and get money to fund the school. That takes up a lot of time. It's like being a politician, right? You need money for your school. But also that we've always, for public schools, provided transportation for students, which is no small thing and no inexpensive thing. So you have to have a base of people who either live very close to the school or have the money to have a car to drive a long time. And if you have a job, you have to get to your job. That's a difficult thing to do.
It is. It is. It's a lot. And I think that that's where, you know, we're starting to see questions under this new administration. If Betsy DeVos is confirmed as education secretary under the Trump administration, where Trump has already signaled that he's very interested in school choice options, I don't know how realistic diverting $20 billion of federal money would be to school, you know, especially to private school choice options. But there's really a question of how these programs play out in rural communities or more sparsely populated communities where there isn't the density of people and the density of schools to be able to choose from a bunch of different programs.
Yes.
You know, in some states, that are, you know, Texas is a prime example of a state that the Republican leadership of that state has been trying to push a voucher program for a number of years now. And they've run up against the fact that lawmakers, including Republicans in rural areas where the school is really the center of, rural life and community life, are not in favor of opening the door to other providers because that starts to divert money from their programs. And so you have this interesting dynamic playing out where there, as especially private school choice programs expand, but also to a certain extent public school choice, you have these interesting issues playing out in more suburban and rural areas where there are really questions now about how these programs will work in places where it's not as easy to just, leave your public school and get to another school down the block.
You had a chance in this fellowship to be able to hear Betsy DeVos before she came to the attention of many other Americans. What did she say at the conference you were at last year, I believe?
So I've seen Betsy speak before. I went to the American Federation for Children conference. They hold an annual policy conference every year. And it's really where the folks who are most interested, for everyone from lawmakers to advocates, most interested in choice for kids. And that, again, can be everything. And when you say choice in the aggregate, it really relates to everything from charter schools to homeschooling to, open enrollment programs that allow people to leave one district, cross a boundary, and go to another district, including vouchers and then kind of newer voucher type systems like tuition tax credits and education savings accounts. The AFC is more focused. I mean, they support all forms of choice, but they really are invested in private school choice. And so at that conference, it's really a place for policy advocates to convene, for there to be a lot of researchers who are invested, sort of from conservative foundations that are eager to show research that in where kids are doing better in choice schools than they are in public schools. And it was really in these conferences where I had a chance to sit down with some newer lawmakers from states who were sort of just getting up to speed on school choice issues. And what I found is that there is a lot of passion and energy around giving kids a shot at if not a better educational experience, a personalized educational experience that would look more like the transition we've made to using Uber instead of just a regular taxi. That parallel was drawn multiple times by folks. And instead of sort of moving away from this staid factory model of education, and really the sentiment at these conferences was that public schools aren't getting it done, aren't changing fast enough, aren't innovative, and why on earth would you continue to support a large bureaucracy that isn't nimble when you have the ability to funnel resources into other programs that give parents more options for their child. And so a lot of the speakers that come to these conferences are sometimes parents of, for example, kids with disabilities who have used some of these specialized choice programs to send their kids to specialized schools. Sometimes it's graduates, and a lot of times it's, a little bit of teacher union bashing on top of that. But again, it's an advocacy conference, so I expected that. What I didn't expect was the lack of conversation about any kind of oversight or accountability. And I understand that if you support the free market, you support choice and, sort of parent choice alone. But I think there was almost a lack of, I don't know if it was an unwillingness to know about the past or just a lack of, if the history of programs like Milwaukee aren't, really being discussed. And I think in some ways people think that it's just like what's happened in Milwaukee is only specific to Milwaukee and won't happen anywhere else. It's almost like we've learned the lessons of what works in Milwaukee. But if that's the case, then I don't know why there isn't a little bit more talk about how we can try to ensure more high quality options and not just more options.
And before we go to phone calls, to go back to when the program started, it was very specific. It was low income students in Milwaukee, poor kids, to give them the options that rich kids had. Now the whole program has changed, and there is some question, and I think legitimately so, of people saying, well, and we've already done this in the state of Wisconsin. We've moved it beyond, so it's not just low income people anymore. It's others who are getting tax deductions who can also avail themselves of choice, leading some to be concerned that the whole public education system really isn't something that people who value it, who are running the country at this point in time. A couple questions is, how did that happen? How did it morph into more than low kids? And two, is there legitimate concern that a lot of people would like to do away with public schools?
Raising the income limits for participation in the voucher program has been a more recent trend, both in Wisconsin and some other states. It's come about especially since Republicans have gained more control of state houses since the 2010 elections. And I think the idea behind that is, look, these options are good for everybody, not just low-income kids. More people, and in some cases, you know, I think the goal for a lot of advocates is universal access, meaning it doesn't matter what income you have, you should be able to take X amount of dollars to whatever school you want. The divide there is that there are some early advocates of vouchers, and one in this city that many people would know well is Howard Fuller, mm-hmm. former Milwaukee Public Schools superintendent, also an early advocate of voucher schools, who has really said, I don't agree with that. I think that if you make my kind of income, you should be able to pay for your own educational options. You have other resources at your disposal. And that's really where a divide is in the actual sort of the current school choice movement. There is a divide between people who feel like these should be universally available to everyone with taxpayer dollars and people that still really feel like, no, wait a minute, the most disadvantaged kids in our cities are the ones that are most likely getting the lowest quality educational experience. Let's really focus our resources on getting those kids a better outcome.
Did you hear people at the conference talk about why do we need public schools?
I think to a certain extent there is that. I don't know how realistic that is. I mean, in one future scenario, I guess you could so break down a public school system that it would only be options out there. I think the reality is a lot of the providers of school, a lot of the people running the choices, don't want to serve all children. They have very specific programs that are really good for certain types of kids, whether that's certain types of kids with learning needs, whether that's certain low-income kids, whether that's kids who are specialized or have a focus in some other, career aspirations,
right,
or religious focus. I mean, those are sort of the options, right? I still think that you're going to wind up with districts serving the bulk of kids whose parents can't or don't know how to exercise choice, or their choice is the public school, because that is where, especially if your child has a significant disability, that is where the most amount of resources still are for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so there isn't a lot. I don't hear that discussed as much from the advocate side of things. And I understand, because I know that they are advocating for the choice. They are not advocating for
right.
the mainstream sort of default option.
Yeah. And yet a lot of people like their public schools. And many of the public schools are very good. Very good.
It's very true. And I think that, the diversity that you see in choice options, whether that's a charter school or a private voucher school or a public school, even in the city of Milwaukee, you can find really good schools mm-hmm. in all of those sectors. And you can find a couple of schools in all of those that you're just like, ooh, why is this still open?
Right.
Like, why is it everybody knows which schools some of those are and we're not really doing anything about it?
Yeah. We are going to go to phone calls. We have many coming in right now. Our number is 800-486-8655. Erin Richards is our guest. She's an education reporter and editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she is the author of a very lengthy piece on Milwaukee's voucher verdict, what 26 years of vouchers can teach the private school choice movement. If only it would listen. She completed this with support from the Spencer Fellowship in Education Reporting at Columbia University. The piece, it's good. It's on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. Okay, let's go to phone calls for Erin, starting with Larry in Milwaukee. Hi, Larry.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Just have a couple of quick comments, and I'll let you guys talk about it. My wife worked at one of these schools right out of college, and she was pretty excited and came home and let me know that the director had a really nice Escalade, did all their shopping in Chicago for, some pretty nice boutiques and clothing and stuff, and wondered how somebody at that level could, you know, live that lifestyle. And shortly, it didn't take long to figure out that their main focus was recruitment and not so much the product, but getting more kids. And it was an interesting time to watch. And she's now an MPS teacher, and the director of that school does not drive an Escalade and shop in Chicago for clothing. So I wonder if you could comment on that.
And what happened to that school that she first taught at? Still in existence?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay. Aaron.
So I think, you know, one barrier to understanding more about the finances of a number of voucher schools in this city is, if anyone's looked up 990 forms, which are, you know, tax forms that nonprofits have to file, if a voucher school in the city is attached to a church, you can't get anything from their 990 that's real useful on salaries. You can find out a little bit more from schools that are not religiously affiliated with a church, because then they actually have to file kind of like a normal 501c3. So sometimes you can get some information about salaries of voucher school workers on those forms. But beyond that, I mean, I think what's been difficult is that, you know, I was spending this fall going through public school teacher and administrator salaries in the entire state. And there's no real way to do that for private schools that get taxpayer money, even though those schools are being supported by taxpayers. But there's no way to know definitively which schools may be really shortchanging their teachers in terms of pay and sort of, you know, bloating the salaries of their staff. Many of these schools, where I hear the most anecdotal, you know, a lot of this is anecdotal reporting or anecdotally what you hear, because you can't prove or disprove
right.
it, the financial forms that those schools file with the state just have to list a gross number for how much they spend on salaries. So that doesn't tell you a lot about where the breakdown is happening. And I do think, I mean, I've heard this same story play out a number of times from folks. And there's just, I mean, you have to kind of internalize it as a reporter and say, well, it really sounds like a shame, but there's no way to definitively track that down. And I understand the aversion from voucher advocates for, you know, having people be more forthright about those issues. But I do think sometimes some more disclosure might be one mm-hmm. way to try to identify which schools might not be putting as many resources into kids and teachers.
And let's talk about disclosure. There was not very much disclosure early on. Have we gotten better about disclosure in terms of suspension, graduation rates, test scores, et cetera?
Yes and no. The voucher program here was a real Wild West in the beginning. In the very beginning of this program in the early 90s, all you needed to open a school was an occupancy permit and parents willing to send their child
really?
To you.
Isn't that amazing?
It. And that's why you had, you know, you had a convicted rapist open one school. You had, you know, people that were clearly spending money on, you know, personal products and expensive luxury items. There has been more disclosure over the years. So to be fair, over the years of this program, it's not like nobody has done anything. Lawmakers have required schools to get accreditation. They have required schools to, you know, submit. They do have to submit financial forms to the state. What we're missing is disclosure on outcome data. So the biggest shift in recent history is that voucher schools do have to administer the state exam to their children, just like the public schools do. And that went a long way, especially in the first year around 2011, to being able to see, whoa, like that's what the scores look like.
Right.
What we don't have is things like, what is your teacher turnover? How much are you paying? What's your starting salary? How much are, you know, what is your suspension rate? A lot of people in the city say, well, voucher schools don't keep the kids. They, you know, they keep them through the third Friday of September headcount for enrollment purposes, which determines your funding for the first part of the year. And then they, you know, kick them out. And then those kids wind up back in the public school. There's no way to prove or disprove that, because we don't know. The schools aren't required. They were for a little bit. They had to talk about how many kids they were retaining from grade to grade. But that provision has kind of quietly dropped off in recent years. So I I think that the big things that we're missing that public schools have to provide, which is things like suspension rates and teacher retention, teacher absences, student absences, those are things that we're really missing from these schools.
Thank you, Larry, very much for your call. And we go next to Lee in Williams Bay. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Kathleen, and hello to your guest. I have 35 years in special education as a speech and language pathologist and 30 extra credits that I've been required to by the state to keep my license. And in my opinion, in Wisconsin, voucher and charter and faith-based schools do not measure up favorably against the public schools. They voucher faith-based and charter schools consistently have lower test scores when compared to the public school test scores. And we're looking at Wisconsin Knowledge Concepts Exam, the new SMART test that was issued about 4 years ago, and MAP testing. And then, I'm sorry, I have a few issues. And then there's the issue of special education needs, which is near and dear to my heart, and the special needs children, and how well are they served in these voucher, charter, and faith-based schools. Finally, what about the separation of church and state? Should our tax dollars be paying for faith-based schools? And I thank you very much for letting me speak.
Of course, Lee. That's what we're here for, and thank you very much.
Okay, I'll start with your last point. I do get this question, leaving Milwaukee and sort of being out around other states, and sometimes you talk to people and they say, what? You have religious schools that get taxpayer money and 100% of kids in a school can be supported by taxpayers and it can be a religious school? And I say, well, yes, the Supreme Court decided that that is okay, and here's why. The money is technically going to the parent, and the parent is choosing that educational program. And to be clear, parents may opt out of the religious programming if they wish. Most parents don't. For many parents, it's an appeal to have that, especially with the growing Latino population in Milwaukee. Having a faith-based school where you can attend for free is really important to a lot of families. And I don't think we should discount that as being something that is very important to a lot of people. We don't know exactly what percentage of kids with special needs are being served by voucher schools. There's a couple of reasons why. One explanation is that voucher schools serve quite a few kids with special needs, but they don't get tracked in the same way as public schools. Public schools, when you have a child with an identified disability, they have a formal paperwork process that's governed by federal law. It's a document that explains the kinds of services your child will get. It has to be signed by the parent and the school. It's a formal document. Private schools, by nature of being private, aren't beholden to that federal law, and so they can serve kids in any way that they wish or that they see fit or perhaps maybe that the parent would like. Sometimes parents don't want their child identified as having a disability, so that could be another barrier. I think that could be something else that maybe people would want to look at. You know, how do we track kids with special needs and how do we tell that voucher schools are giving them the services they deserve? I think most advocates would say, well, if you're a parent of a child with a special needs, you are actively choosing that school. And if you don't like the kind of education you're receiving, you're more than welcome to leave and go back to some other program that serves them better, whether mm-hmm. that's another private school or the local public school. To Lee's point about the qualifications of teachers, one requirement that was passed in through the evolution of the voucher program in Milwaukee, and this applies to voucher schools that now exist statewide as well, is that voucher teachers do have to have at least a bachelor's degree to teach. In the early days of the program, the Wild West days, you didn't have to have any qualification. So requiring that people at least have a bachelor's degree is a step toward trying to ensure a baseline of education among teachers. Anecdotally, it's pretty easy to hear that folks will, for example, trade out a teacher that doesn't have a degree with somebody else who does when the accreditors come through for a visit. It's very hard to tell if that's accurate. in part because I've tried to check with the state before and say, can I, you know, this is a law. Schools have to have right. teachers with bachelor's degrees. Can I get a list of all the teachers in a school and make sure that they have bachelor's degrees? The state says, well, we're not actually allowed to collect that. That is supposed to be overseen by the accreditation agencies that accredit these schools to exist. In some cases, the very people running voucher schools sit on the boards of accreditation agencies. So it can, and those are private agencies. They don't have to disclose the kinds of information they're collecting from the schools. So
are they reputable organizations? Some of them? Many of them?
Yeah, yes. Some of them are absolutely reputable outfits. In recent years, lawmakers have realized that some voucher schools in Milwaukee have gotten savvy about which ones are not and have gotten into the program by way of going through an accreditation agency, which was more interested in the money than actually assuring the quality of the program. And so the state tightened language in recent years to try to make sure that more reputable agencies were approving these schools.
Yeah. And what about, you heard for years that, well, everybody was doing much better in voucher schools, in private voucher than in public schools. Do we have reliable measurements now? Are people being better educated in public, in private schools and public schools? What's the story?
One thing we've seen since the state testing requirement went into place in 2011 is that voucher school scores have increased. That could be because of the public pressure to show that your test scores are getting better. It also depends on how you compare the numbers for state test results in Wisconsin between the voucher schools and the public schools specifically. If you're only comparing the low-income children in Milwaukee public schools to the low-income children in voucher schools, which advocates generally say is all the population of kids in voucher schools, then you see that the disparity between the scores is wider. And in some cases, the voucher school students are outscoring MPS on that measure. Many people, including myself, don't use that particular measure because more and more children in the voucher program are now mixed middle income. You can receive a voucher now to go to a school if your family makes up to $70,000 a year. I don't consider that low income in the same way as if we're comparing a child from a family right at the poverty level or below.
Yes.
So I think that measure is a little bit shaky to use because it's like one way you compare, if you just compare low-income kids, voucher schools are a little bit ahead. If you just compare the entire populations of each, public schools are a little bit ahead. Now that voucher schools have had to take the ACT test at the high school level, on the most recent administration of that test, voucher schools were a little bit higher. Is that because, you know, the high schools can be more selective and there aren't as many high schools operating at the level? It's really expensive to run a high school. So you see more elementary and K-8 voucher schools than you do high schools. You could explain that by a number of mm-hmm. ways as well, which public school advocates do. So I think that what we can say, the kind of the generally accepted explanation is that there isn't a lot of difference between the voucher schools and the public schools in terms of performance. There's some wiggle room depending on how you look at the numbers and depending on what aspect you're looking at. Voucher schools have gotten a little bit better in recent years, but I think the expectation was this was supposed to be, you know, this was going to lift all
right.
boats in Milwaukee.
Right.
Everybody was going to benefit. The public schools were going to benefit from competition. The voucher schools were going to knock it out of the park. And that, I mean, getting close to that promise.
It hasn't
really happened.
Yeah. Lee, thanks for the call. Charlie in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is kind of a segue from your previous caller in that a lot of people talk about the benefits of public education and they chart statistics and facts, yet parents making a decision for their child are still feeling that the voucher schools or the school choice programs are a better fit for their child. So the question I have is, why do parents still want to send their child to a school choice program and obviously feel that the public schools are not fitting their child's needs when, in fact, the public schools do all these things? Is it safety? Is it is it just better schooling or a better fit for that child? And if so, what's wrong with a parent making a decision for their child?
Yeah, it's a good question, Charlie, and you cover that in your article. Aaron.
I spent a lot of time during the 2015-16 academic year, flying back to Milwaukee and spending time with families in Milwaukee and also in Racine, where the voucher program expanded first before it expanded statewide. And I spent time with parents and talked to them about why they were choosing this particular voucher school. And oftentimes, high-quality education wasn't the predominant factor. It was this school is close to me, or I like the community, or I go to the church and it makes sense to have my child go to the church. Sometimes it was that, you know, one was attached to a Boys and Girls Club. Perceptions of safety. We don't have good data, like official comparable data between public schools and voucher schools when it comes to safety. There are some reports floating out there that indicate that voucher schools have a little bit, or that are safer. I'm still looking for comparable data between the two of those, but there certainly is a perception that those schools are safer. Often the class sizes are much smaller. Mm. There is more of a community feel just because it's a smaller school often. And so I think that's really why a lot of parents are choosing. In Racine especially, I spent a lot of time with a mom who had a number of kids who she'd adopted, and a lot of them had a very diverse range of learning needs, from pretty heavy special education to sort of, you know, minor learning needs, but they all the kids did really well when they got a little bit more personalized attention. And for her, the school that she sent her children to was the New Hope Christian School down in Racine, and for her it was really important to have. She really liked the highly structured classrooms and it was high discipline, you know, sort of silent in the hallways, very disciplined about, you know, silent snack time and sort of a very regimented day. And she felt that her children excelled in that environment. She really liked the faith-based component of that school. In Milwaukee, sometimes there isn't a lot of knowledge among parents about that this school is a district school and this school is a voucher school. It's just a school, mm-hmm. right? I think in sometimes, you know, in sort of advocacy circles, we draw thicker lines around these schools and tell a lot of parents in the community, it's just like that school happened to work and my aunt sent her kids there or my cousin sends her kids there. And so you just send your kids there. There isn't as much knowledge of, oh, like this is a choice school. Right. So I'm going to go to this school specifically.
Thanks, Charlie, for the call. Stay on hold if that's where you are. We're going to continue. We're speaking with Erin Richards this hour. She's the education reporter and editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and author of a very important piece, A History of Milwaukee's Voucher Verdict, What 26 Years of Vouchers Can Teach the Private School Choice Movement If Only It Would Listen. It's in the winter 2017 issue of the American Prospect magazine, which is on our Facebook page, and it's a lengthy, important read, and our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. And our next call is Bob. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Hi.
I don't know where to start with this. Wisconsin has been a pioneer in education. If you look at Chapter 89 and Chapter 90 of state statutes, and you look at 94-142 of the federal statutes, you'll find that the state was ahead of the feds with special needs education provisions. You'll find that we were into this early, and consequently, we have a lot of experience to draw on. If you want to look at credibility, reliability, and validity of numbers and so forth, the public education system in the state of Wisconsin has a lot to offer. As I look at it and I watch what's going on here, is there any real checks and balances on these other schools? I wonder how some of these folks would feel about funding a school that leaned towards the Muslim faith or the Jewish faith rather than some of the Christian schools that we're supporting here. As a taxpayer of long standing, I'm 78 years old and a retired educator, I really have questions about what's going on here. What are these people going to do with children with severe and profound disabilities, children that are maybe in diapers or children that can't walk or so forth? Really, are we comparing apples and oranges here? The public education system, I have grandchildren that have gone through the system. They've done very well at the college level. My children are all college educated. One of them has a PhD. Another one has a master's in engineering management and so forth. One's a paper scientist. I think to sell our public education system short is very, very foolish.
Aaron.
I think one thing we have to acknowledge in this state is that we've had choice, a vast number of choice options, at least in Milwaukee, and we're starting to see more of them in the rest of the state as well. And I think we have to acknowledge that parents like choice. There is a demand for choice in the city and in the state. And however our personal feelings may be toward that, there are a lot of parents that want those options. The door has been open to those options, and I don't see the door closing on those options. When it comes to special needs specifically, voucher schools, they have to accept all kids who meet the requirements, which is generally an income requirement in most programs, and they have to live in for the Milwaukee program, they live in the city of Milwaukee. They can inform a family that they may not be able to serve their child's special education needs, and then it's up to the family whether they would still like to enroll in that school or not. In recent year, in the last legislative session, we passed a special needs scholarship program, which actually provides a much greater amount of funding, I think around $12,000 or so for children with special needs to attend a school of their choice. Some voucher schools in the city were very good at trying to shift some of their existing voucher families of kids with special needs onto that higher paying tuition voucher so that they could continue to serve those children, but also have more resources to serve those children. So I think, you know, especially at schools that were very keen on trying to get those kids with special needs more resources, which in general, from what I reported, was your higher performing, more transparent voucher, you know, private schools that get tuition vouchers. So I do think there is a desire there from some voucher operators to serve those kids. I think in other schools, there is less attention to that. And just to your point, Bob, about other schools, there actually are a number of voucher schools in Milwaukee that do serve kids of a Muslim faith and of
and
the Jewish
faith.
Jewish faith. There are a couple of voucher schools in the Sherman Park neighborhood that are 100% Jewish kids, and those are really popular schools. And quite honestly, they have some of the highest test scores in the city. The children there get a robust education. It is a very tight community. It's Jewish teachers. It's Jewish kids. It's families from the neighborhood. Most people walk. And those, you know, those schools don't serve as many kids as the Catholic and the Lutheran schools are more common, but we absolutely do have some of those schools that are serving kids of more, of the Muslim and Jewish faith as well. And they are quite popular with families, especially that are seeking that kind of education.
Thanks, Bob, very much. What about this thought? We have Barb from South Range of Wisconsin saying, I don't want my tax dollars used for parochial education, just like conservatives don't want their tax dollars funding public radio and television. Keep religious education separate. Is that an idea that's passé now?
I really think we're past that argument. The courts have decided that this is constitutional. We have seen that parents want these programs. I think when it comes down to the expansion of these programs, especially at the state level, that's where you would be more likely to see people be able to call their lawmaker and say, I don't want my dollars to go to that kind of program. We haven't seen as much of that. There has been some organizing by, you know, public school advocates to block those programs. To be frank, a lot of the expansion of voucher programs has come as policy tucked into the state budget, which for anyone who's covered the state budget, the final hours and days of the state budget is a whole lot of behind-the-scenes horse trading, and stuff comes out really fast. And all of a sudden, we have a special needs voucher bill that nobody really had the capacity to stop because it was already kind of a done deal behind the scenes. So and not to say that you know isn't a program that's helping some people, but it did come together without much public input in the 11th hour. And so I think in some ways for people that don't want their tax dollars to go to these programs, it's really critical to be in touch with your local representatives and be telling them how you feel.
Let people know. Let's go to Justin in La Crosse. Short on time. Hi, Justin.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I know you're short on time. I have a two-part question. First is informative. Where does most of the tax dollars come from that funds public education? And then my second question is, do you think that there's possibly a hidden agenda, now I'm not talking conspiracy, but a hidden agenda to keep people who are impoverished by not educating them, then further perpetuating the cyclical cycle of uneducation, poverty, crime, so forth.
All right, Justin, thanks very much for your call.
I'll take your second question first. Could there be some people that feel like this is a way to sort of keep disadvantaged populations continually disadvantaged? Perhaps. I think that the bulk of people working in education are in it for the right reasons. It's a really hard profession to be in if you don't actually care about kids. There are far more ways to make money and better money doing easier jobs than educating kids. So I don't think that that's it's certainly nothing I ran into that I could sort of uncover in my research. There may be some people that feel that way, but I think the bulk of people in this are they're well-meaning. I think sometimes they're well-meaning, but they don't know what they're doing. But I think most people really are trying to give kids a good education.
And in terms of the taxes, we got 10 seconds.
Goodness. most funding for schools comes from local tax dollars. There is state money as well. And how much your local community gets depends on a very complicated formula.
Thank you, Aaron, very much. Aaron Richards, for more information, please go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can read her whole report. She's education reporter and editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks to Marika Saval for producing this show and to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Thanks for listening, everybody. We're with you again tomorrow.